Log Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is syndicatednews.net again, and tonight we're introducing Men Matter. The show is hosted by Dr. James Wardner, and his guest this evening is Dr. Kevin McGuire from Alaska. Gentlemen?
Good evening, Ruthie.
Well, now, you're get to it. I'm going to back out and have a happy new year. I'll be here manning the phones if you need my help. Gentlemen, proceed.
Thank you, Ruth.
Dr. McGuire, it's really nice to chat with you this evening on the end of 2010, the beginning of 2011. Some parts of the world have already started a new year. Excuse me. And I've spoken to you before, but just briefly. And for the benefit of the people who will be coming to syndicatednews.net or who are already here, since I know a little bit about you, but I'm sure they would like to know also, I was wondering if you could just share with us what you're doing right now for work, where you're living, where you're calling in from, and how things are weather-wise from, and I know where you are, but maybe you'd let us in on what's going on in your world at the present time.
Sure, and it is good to talk to you again. It's been, perhaps a month since we first spoke.
Yes.
So I'm glad for the opportunity, and thank you so much for thinking of me. This is an important topic, and I'm happy to be able to contribute. Well, as you know, I'm up in Anchorage, Alaska, and I do family practice. I've been up in Alaska since 1982, came up with the Army. And like so many of us who came here, we decided simply not to leave and not go back to the lower 48, as we rightfully or wrongfully label the folks who are not here, and do family practice, and have done that since I've been here. And we came to meet over topics involved with our children and ourselves in a divorce and post-divorce situation, and the difficulty that has on our kids. And much like yourself, my situation and that of my kids, of course, will be 10 years in the making as of March. So the longevity that what we're going to be talking about tonight is almost a topic in and of itself. It points to the difficulty in addressing the things we're likely going to hit tonight as topics, and that these effects can have far-reaching aspects. You mentioned, what am I doing for work? Family practice. But as we'll likely discuss along the way, these situations impact every facet, at least in my life, every facet of my life. And it's difficult to get through that, and sometimes even more difficult to get back on the normal track or as close as possible. And those effects, at least as far as I've found, are excruciatingly hard to deal with. But it pointed out to me, and has over the years, how difficult it must be for my kids to deal with that, who have nowhere near the decades of education or coping skills or just experience in life to filter and cope with what goes on, as we're going to talk about here in a little bit.
Well, Dr. McGuire, I'd like to, I know a little bit about what it takes to get through medical school, but would you mind giving the listeners a little idea as to maybe where you attended undergraduate school, where you went to medical school? Did you do any residency training? Were you preparing for any kind of a specialty? I understand you're doing general practice now. It would be interesting, I think, for people to understand where you're coming from academically and a little bit of your academic history.
Sure. I went to the University of Notre Dame, and from there to medical school on an Army scholarship at the University of Medicine and Biosciences in Kansas City. graduated with a DO, that's a Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine. Did my internship in Hawaii. Went back to Washington, D.C. for a year. And then transferred up here to Alaska to one of the infantry divisions. And in 1987, took a local job, not wanting to be transferred out. So I had 9 years in, almost 10, at the time I decided to leave the service and join the civilian ranks so that I could stay in Alaska. And worked in family practices and urgent cares. And then in 1992, everyone's aware of the oil field up here, Prudhoe Bay. I started work up there as a North Slope physician up on the edge of northern Alaska there by the Arctic Ocean, and met my, at the time, future wife in 1994, who also worked there. We married in 96, and between 96 and 2000 had three wonderful kids, and sought to do a residency at that point. And in 2000, I was accepted to a radiology residency in Michigan. So we packed everything up, and I went down, got us a house. And then in October of 2000, mom and the kids came down, moved in into the new house. Nice little fixer-upper there in a good neighborhood that lots of trees and tree-lined streets. And started off on what was to have been the big career change, and certainly an area I'm very much interested in. And we were there perhaps 5 months. This was March. And if you'll allow me to segue that into tonight's topic, when, as I say, things started. So does that seem like a pretty good way to start off?
Yeah, I was interested for the listeners to come to understand that you were accepted into this residency, that you were accepted in the residency, but not everyone gets accepted into a residency like this. It would have been important to your career. And could you explain a little bit about how things followed after that and how it affected that particular residency and your opportunities for the future?
Sure. A brief overlook at how things went. The area we were in, Michigan, my wife at the time, her extended family was there. She was actually born not very far from where our house was in Michigan at the time. Okay. And lots of extended family, which was great. When you're in a residency, it's pretty much like it sounds. It's you reside in the hospital, so to speak.
Surely.
Actually how it was originally back many, many moons ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were other kids and cousins and aunts and uncles and a host of people. And so it was actually a very comfortable position. And while I would have been off at work 90% of the time or 80% of the time during the day, my wife, well, her name was Lisa. Lisa and the kids could go out and do whatever with a variety of relatives. And it was ideal setup for us. Well, things were good. And then we were there about 2 months when our oldest daughter was making comments about missing Alaska and asking us if we were never going to leave. And, you know, what prompted that, we thought it was just homesickness, quote unquote, because she'd been born and spent her first 4 years in Alaska. So with the residency, back to what you're saying, it's you immerse yourself in it, and it really takes 110% of your mental energy while you're at work. It's back to school plus. And it, like any residency, requires lots of attention, lots of time, even when you're not in the hospital. So that I was at work a lot, we thought that might have been part of it. You know, dad's working and, you know, not around. Sometimes you might spend every other weekend working most of the weekend, including the week. So a difficult transition perhaps, but it seemed like it was smoothing until December. Then that quieted down for a while. And then back to the usual work routine. And then in January and February, some more of that surfaced with my oldest daughter and then our middle daughter, who at the time was 2.5. And not sure of what that was, but we thought it was just this transition again. And again, the residency, as you were saying, I mean, you don't mean to segue back, but you know, the selection process is very particular. It involves lots of interviews, qualifications, reviews, and it's competitive to say the least. And so this was quite literally at the time the opportunity of a lifetime for us to make a change at sort of mid-career in medicine was both welcome and difficult at the same time. So that stress surrounding the amount of time that it took to be a resident and not be at the house and have that limited contact for a short period, we thought that might have been part of it. And so things improved over the next few months. We had party at the house once we got it fixed up for all of Lisa's relatives, kids, everyone came over. We spent Thanksgiving at her aunt's. Again, same number and same people that were at our party. And just, it felt very welcoming for us. And
all seemed normal at that point in time.
It did. It was very nice to have an extended family. We were instantaneously surrounded by a comfort zone that I think was unique for a lot of people.
But the two children at that point in time were showing some signs of affectation. You just didn't know what it was.
Yeah. And if you're a little kid and you move somewhere and everything's new, it's different. It's not like your first day at school. It's completely different. So it was reassuring to have every manner of family around. And then as a book might start, that all changed.
Okay.
On March 10, 2001. And as the book would also say, and here our story begins.
So, yes.
That's sort of the intro to how I went down this path, our kids went down this path, how this has begun. So things were good, life was good, luck was on our side, opportunity was there, I was fortunate. Everything was lining up. And then things changed.
Now, Dr. McGuire, I'm just kind of calendarizing here, and I'm looking at my little sheet of paper, and I'm seeing that add a couple of months to this picture here in 2011. We're looking at 10 years now has gone by since the beginning of this story that you just mentioned. And can you summarize? Here's what I heard. Here's the doc. He's got the wife. He's got children. He's surrounded by family members and friends. He's working his tail off to be successful. He's in a program that not a schmuck would get into or a lower academic individual, but only a person who's well-chosen and outstanding in his field would get into a program like this. He has a home, and all is good. All would appear to be good, and you thought things were good, and you're a doctor, and you probably have a pretty good sense of when things are good. So what happened? Where are we now? Okay, if you don't mind me just jumping 10 solid big old years, where are you now with your situation? Can you explain that? Can we just jump 10 years and explain what you're doing right now and where you are with your children? And then we can go back and fill in the spaces, but I think obviously something has happened, and that's with the story. If you don't mind going down that way, I'd like to know.
actually, that's probably a better way to approach it. A lot of, I think we were watching a movie the other day, and it started out with all these frenetic and kind of unbelievable circumstances for this couple. And it goes on for about 5 minutes, and then the screen goes blank just when it looks like there's going to be this terrible thing happening. And at the bottom it says, 4 years earlier, which is probably a good way to approach things, like how did we get here? And that's a good circumstance. So right now, I'm here in Alaska, and our kids are down in Colorado. Have been there since June of 2003, so that's 7.5 years. In the time since they have been in Colorado, I've seen them, I'll round it off, 40 times.
So just let me clarify, if you don't mind. So between June of 2003 and today, you've seen the children 40 times?
At a max. I'm just going off the top of my head.
Okay.
Because the numbers get jumbled.
Okay.
There's so many. But let's call it 40 times.
Okay.
And for a total of perhaps 50 hours.
Okay.
All of my presents for birthdays and cards for graduation, for any occasion, for school, all are sent back with return to sender on them, written by mom. Cards from my family, for instance, from my mom, and presents are sent back in the same fashion. I have to get my information about their health status by calling the doc, and I'm not kept up on up-to-date items for their health. I have not spoken to my kids as we're on the phone right now. I haven't spoken to them since September 2009.
Oh.
I haven't seen their faces in person. I haven't been able to get any communication to them that I know of if things are returned. I find myself now having, over this 10-year period, there are several stains, which I'm in the process of working on, but may not happen, regarding allegations made by my ex against my medical license in 3 states. I have been the subject of 7 separate investigations as my ex has moved from Michigan to Alaska to Colorado. As one is dismissed and thrown out, another one suddenly takes its place. There have been crushing financial costs. As a round number, just lumping it up very quickly, it's at a minimum of $500,000. It's wiped out pretty much every cent I have, and more to come. And I must deal now with, at least in the medical aspect of things, privileges or practices or insurance or even simply getting a position at another practice. I must always deal with one of the lines commonly seen on applications and privilege at hospital forms. Have you ever been accused of? ... And you must answer yes, of course, because that's the way it is. And let me introduce the words here that we're going to be talking about, at least in my case. Along the way, these were false allegations of sexual abuse of my children made by my wife, now ex, over the course of these many years and continuing, which has poisoned the medical cleanliness of my career and record, and no amount of explanation No amount of paperwork, no amount of this was proven to be false and fabricated, can get people past the first thing that they feel in their gut when they read those words. You know, why was this investigation conducted? Because there were allegations of child sexual abuse. I think it's a normal human reaction to just have a shutdown for anything that follows that. It takes time to digest that, and certainly in the medical world, it is, in large measure, a deal breaker. And so now I find myself fortunate to be here in Alaska, in the sense that I've been here all these years and people know me, and many of the folks that I've worked with are, yeah, we know, it's don't worry about it. But that doesn't count for everyone, and it certainly hasn't been able to be overcome in Colorado, where I've tried to get to be with the kids. And I don't see much of an end to that, absent significant dollars and legal intervention to go try to expunge the record. And so I went from welcome home, Dad, with my then not yet one-year-old son, he wasn't speaking, but, and two-and-a-half and four-year-old daughters, happy and pictures and Christmas and running and, you know, goodnight prayers and going to the park, and we lived near a zoo. Everything that you would consider to be, wow, this is great. This is why life is good. To not just the opposite, but worse than the opposite. That is, having destroyed everything, and the effect is not limited to me. Our kids have suffered, have had to go through the same things that I've gone through. And we can perhaps hit on some details of how this affects thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, men and women, parents and children, around the country in this process that we're going to discuss.
Well, so I want to back up. Interesting story, and I think people are going to want to know about what's going on here. I want to ask you some questions. I did some tallying while you were speaking. 40 times for approximately 50 hours, I tallied up the period of time from June 03. I could be off here or there a little bit, but I came up with 90 months, a total of 90 months. And really, we're talking about approximately 7.5 years to the present time. And in 90 months, you've seen your children 40 times for 50 hours. So that's not enough to even know who you're dealing with, is it?
No, it hasn't. And I think that is, it's a very large part of it here. Let me, perhaps of the two of us, let me be the first to put these words forward so we can perhaps use them more freely during the remainder of the time. Over these last 10 years, I've come to, and other people who've evaluated this, and experts and folks around the therapeutic and social services, law enforcement, everyone I've come in contact with who has had some measure of reasonable exposure is aware of these words, and that is parental alienation. Now, before anyone out there may be listening saying, oh my gosh, we're off on this parental alienation syndrome, I want to avoid here using the syndrome moniker. I'm not going to get into that. I don't want to. It's a separate issue. Here I would prefer to say, and I've had others agree, and certainly that is a common designation anymore, that what has gone on is parental alienation processes, activities that are done specifically to separate children from a parent, and do so under circumstances that essentially don't just drive a wedge, but realign the natural affections of children away from one parent, vilifying them, and towards another parent. Some of the listeners may recognize alienating parent versus targeted parent. Whatever the designation people choose to use, it is a one-sided, almost no-option position that our kids have been placed into by their mother in this case.
And gentlemen, I want to take just one little second here to welcome the guests from Canada and the United States. We have guests sitting in the chat room. Welcome from Canada and welcome from the U.S. Welcome to syndicatednews.net. This is the debut show of Men Matter. Now I'll go back to the chat room. Continue.
So that's, I think, it's perhaps that's a long way of bringing it up, but as it gets more attention now, been a lot in the press and the medical and psychiatric literature about the upcoming DSM. That's the it's essentially, it's the book that says what is and is not a disorder or disease. And many folks want to include parental alienation syndrome as a psychiatric designated disease or disorder.
Well, Dr. McGuire,
I don't want to address that here today.
I want to ask you a question. If you picked up the phone right now to call your children, what would happen?
Click. And what would happen after the click would be what I have known has happened from reports that have happened years ago. He knows where we live. What if he calls again? Is he coming? I'm scared. What will we do? Call the police. I could go on.
Let me step into this for just a minute. I want to make sure that not only do I know, but whoever might be listening to this. When I said if you called your children and this click occurs, would that click occur whether you spoke or attempted to speak either to the children, any of the children, or your ex-wife? Or is this just the ex-wife? Or how is this just click across the board?
Well, my children would just, at this point, hang up because that's how they've been groomed to act. If I had called and my ex answered or I said, please put, one of the kids on, that might be met with anything from a threat of I'm going to call someone or call the police or call the court to perhaps, I think more likely at this point, running down and getting a restraining order or, based on what's happened in the past, some other comment or allegation would be attributed to that. But in any event, it would, with my children, they have been so deeply ingrained in this separation and having to choose and excluded from information that they're left with no other recourse. They've got to follow what mom says to do, or there are consequences for them. And actually, we can speak to that. There are some specifics that have happened in this that are egregious, but I could never get them addressed.
Well, I'd like to chase down this trail for just a second, Dr. McGuire. You're making a phone call from Alaska. I think that's more than a couple miles from Colorado. If you pick up the phone and you attempt to call your children, where is your ex-wife coming from if she could even dream to say such a thing as, I'm going to get a restraining order? Does that make any sense to you?
No, but the entire process makes no sense unless you entertain certain reasons for why she would do that.
Right. Well, at one point in time, you mentioned to me that things had gotten so out of hand, so crazy, that you actually had to have a listener on the phone when you were talking to your children. Could you explain that and how that came about?
This goes back now many years. When phone calls were still, I would call them every day, good night, how are you doing? Shortly after that, they started to change and not wanted to speak. And I said, I better have someone here to listen to this. So now we're going back over 8 years when we were here in Alaska. And let me give you an example of why. I at one time called up, and they were heading off to bed. Good night, I love you, and love you, Dad. And they were still speaking like kids would speak to a dad. And I made some comment. Are you still there?
I'm right here.
Oh, okay, I heard a click like we might have been off the air. Shortly after that, there was a woman, I think it was the GAL, said that I needed not to bring up certain topics. I couldn't talk about how things were going and I'll see you soon. And I was once actually chided for saying to my own children, I'll see you soon, when that was made brought to the attention of the guardian ad litem at the time. She told me that I was not to say that to them because there was no assurance that I would see them soon. Now, they're hearing this. You know, it's brought back to the house, I think, and there, my children are left to deal with that. That is to say that the conversation has now gone from "How are you doing?" and "I'll see you soon," and "Well, we'll go do this," to almost banter. How are you doing? How are you feeling? How is this? At one point, I was told not to ask about school. So the problem extends to every level of the relationship with my children. And I think it requires a little bit of perhaps a little bit more detail here about how I got to this point. As we're saying, we're back in the movie. How did we get to here?
Hey, Doc, hang on for just a minute. I just wanted to say to the people who are joining us and in the chat room listening to us, thank you, folks, for participating, and thank you for listening. And we certainly hope you're enjoying, not enjoying necessarily, but learning something from what you're hearing. Go ahead, Doc.
Well, let me give you the cook's tour of, and it'll probably take 5 minutes. I could probably speak for the rest of the night on this, but just a very quick.
I'm watching my own clock here, and try to hit the highlights, because I know this conversation could take us 3 hours. We don't have that amount of time.
Here is the Cliff Notes view of this tragedy. March 10, 2001 is when my oldest daughter, after we had a party for some of the other folks at the hospital, there was an 8-year-old boy there, and she said that the boy had touched her. Well, we called the parents up, and that didn't, you know, we don't know what happened, if anything. And over the ensuing weeks, my daughter named an adult cousin of my wife. And it happened more than once. She said it happened at Thanksgiving and made specific references. We filed a police report. They investigated. My daughter even identified this guy down to a tattoo on his hip. Huh. Well, then my daughter was recommended that we take her to a local social worker therapist to help her deal with things. We did describe, and I mentioned before, these kind of homesick behaviors, a little affectation. We didn't know, but now this really brought our attention to those. In the middle of all this, unbeknownst to me, my wife decides to just say, oh, Kevin did this. Kevin touched them. Kevin that, now, not heard of before, nothing there, no, literally out of the blue. Along the way, she secreted funds away, planned to leave, all the while telling, I think it was a social services lady who said, how are things? And she said, oh, our marriage is fine. I'm just, you know, worried what might be going on with the kids, and we don't want you to take them away from us. I was asked to leave my own house on my son's first birthday, when social services came to the house and talked to my wife. And shortly after that, the process began. She fabricated information, literally lied to the police, saying that this therapist had told her to question our daughter at home, and that somehow my name had been introduced, Kevin, but my daughter doesn't call me Kevin. One thing leads to another, and the system, as it were, geared up. I'm put out of the house. I can't come, you know, I can come back and see them at public places, but not into the house. About 6 weeks later, my ex gets on a plane, takes the kids to Alaska, and says, don't follow us, you'll be sorry, and then urges me to go along with the investigation. Well, I do, but no one will tell me what we're investigating. And I don't have this information at the time. I've just spoken about this other guy. And well, the summer comes up, and the investigation closes, and they say there's nothing here. My ex then files a restraining order 10 weeks later, keeping me from even contacting the kids. That separates us for a year. And a year later, after a year of therapy in Alaska, they're brought back to Michigan, where my oldest daughter is re-interviewed. Any one of our listeners here will, you know, that this is now becoming a poison project. They go back to the same place they were originally interviewed, and now my daughter says, Kevin touched me. From there, it spirals down. I'm separated again. I have to have supervision. And then by the time it gets around to a custody eval in the court, I've lost my residency. I have no money. Kids are in Alaska. I'm in Michigan. No hope of a job. And mom gets sole fiscal. We have joint legal. I'm advised to go to Alaska and get a job. And poof, there we go. Once in Alaska, the same thing happens. I'm under supervised visitation for a year. For what? I don't know. Another allegation is made, and that is dismissed as unfounded. But along the way, she makes allegations to the medical boards, which puts me in the realm of having to check that box. Have you ever been investigated? So now it's difficult to get work. June 2003, they go down to Colorado, where they're immediately placed in therapy at a group of therapists who do sexual abuse and sexual recovery issues. I meet with these people several months after that, and they say, you'll just have to admit to something so we can help your kids move ahead. And I said, no. Admit to what? Meanwhile, despite all this investigation things, when people are telling me there's nothing to look at, social services is walking away. About 3 days after my second time down there to see our kids, mom says that my son, who at the time was three, even though we were at a supervised visit, mom says to the social services folks,
time to time. We'll correct it in the next when we finish the recording.
Okay.
Let me bring Jim back in. And I want to welcome the guests in this show. It's interesting because this show is not advertised. And I am just very, very happy to have so many guests visiting and listening in. We appreciate you. We're going to add Dr. Wardner now.
Dr. Wardner's here.
Ah, perfect. Carry on, gentlemen. Thank you, everyone, for visiting the show, and I'll back myself back into the tech room. Gentlemen, continue.
I'm not sure where I left off there, Jim, with the cutoff.
You were just talking, you were getting to the second time I think you'd gone to visit. There had been a supervised visit. Then apparently another allegation had been made, and that's when I lost you.
My ex said that while driving in the car, my three-year-old son said that Kevin touched his penis. Well, she filed
a supervised visit.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And that I had done these things and wiggled this and done that. And I don't know how much you can put in there. There's some specifics that she alleged. But so they investigate it. They take him to a forensic interview, and they say there's nothing here, blah, blah. That's when I meet with these therapists who say, you should admit to something, and we can get on the road to healing your kids, to which I essentially said, hell no, this is wrong. This is ridiculous. Well, I keep seeing them, and then about 6 weeks later, I'm told that I can have no physical contact with my children during a visit because they're investigating me. And I said, for what? Well, they won't tell me. And then they cut off visits shortly after that in October. And then in December, I get what I call the letter. I receive a letter that says that I have been placed on a perpetrator list for medium sexual abuse. Now, I'm not making those words up. Medium sexual abuse of all three of my children, according to a social worker who reviewed these notes. Now, there is no such thing, as I've learned, as medium sexual abuse. Anywhere in the U.S., I consulted the Supreme Court of Colorado Library, that even the law enforcement folks I talked to have never heard of it. But it sprung out of the social services being zealous, talking to the therapist who said they're recovering memories, all to the contrary of anything that's gone before, and all stemming from mom. So I'm now
Doc, I got to stop you for a minute, and it's me that has to stop you. I need to ask you a question. I don't know about the listeners. I'm sure they've got a million questions also, but I just have to ask this one question. You're put on a perpetrator list after having an allegation against you for some kind of physical contact, which was supervised. My
yes.
question is, who made that decision? Was it a social service employee? Was it a therapist? Was it a psychologist? Was it a counselor? Who was that? Was it a individual? Was it more than one individual? Can you explain that?
I can't, because they won't tell me.
It's all immunity. It's all anonymous, right?
No.
No?
My ex made the report to social services that this...
Right. But the investigators...
Of hearing my son say this. Okay.
Yes.
She's the only one that ever hears any of this.
Yes, of course.
And then one social services worker apparently placed me, or had authority to, place me on this list of all three of my children. So now I couldn't get anyone to ask me to tell me how that happened. Nor, despite repeated letters and calls, could I even get a definition of what that is.
Now, did you have an attorney at this time?
I did. And he worked on it. Now, they said you can appeal this. Well, here's another part of this alienation stuff.
Let me break in again, and we're not going to get through this today. I can see this. We're going to have a part two. I hope we can do it. The attorney couldn't find out who made these decisions either?
No, wouldn't tell him.
They wouldn't tell him either. He couldn't subpoena records. He couldn't get the information.
Yeah, he could have, except that by the time it got to me that I was on this list,
yes,
the time for appeal had passed.
Unbelievable.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because the social services people, instead of sending that to my address, sent it to the address of my ex-wife, who opened the letter that said to be opened by addressee only, crossed off her address, wrote in her own handwriting my address, and then somehow it managed to get to me 3 weeks after the deadline had passed. So when I called to get, when we called to get this, you know, appeal going, they said, well, no, you missed the deadline. We had to appeal to the Attorney General's office. That took until August 2004, at which time they decided that the report was inaccurate and there was no reason to have any report at all, and it was dismissed entirely as there's nothing here. There's no evidence that this was an accurate report of any kind. And so I lost a year with our kids. So that brings us to September 2004, when we're supposed to start this, quote, reunification process. This is another show, by the way, on some of that. But 10 days
at least
before, 10 days before the reunification process starts, my ex files a complaint with social services. You're never going to believe it, but it's true. It's in paper. While driving down the road in a similar fashion to the year before, she tells the social services investigator that my son, now 4 and a half, just remembered when he was 3 and a half, a year ago, that he forgot to tell her that dad had done other things to him at the supervised visit. So they started an investigation. In the middle of that, my middle child, our daughter, was taken to a forensic interview. It's the first time she's ever been interviewed because her, quote, abuse therapist said that she should go. She wanted to say something. So they brought her to the, and this is a very significant point, they brought her to the interview, and in the middle of it, the interviewer says, well, why do you say these things? Why are you saying these things about Kevin? I'm no longer dad now, I'm Kevin.
You're Kevin.
And my daughter smartly and cleanly says, well, now that my mom told me about it, that it was my other dad, Kevin, blah, 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 blah. Now, I ran that by as many psychologists as I could find, and they all said, there you go. This is why it's called alienation or brainwashing or programming. That information was kept from me for well over a year. In fact, it was kept from the court so that this reunification never had any urgency to it. No one stopped and said, oh, my God, it's been made up. Mom told the kids to make these allegations. It proceeded.
I need to break in again one more time, if you don't mind.
Sure.
It was kept from you, and it was kept from the court. And we're going to have some opportunity in the future to talk about the system that you so aptly described. I forget how you stated the system went into. How did you say that? That was quite well stated. The system geared up. That's what you said. And
yes,
I smiled when you said that because I know exactly how that system can gear up. But anyway, it was kept from you. This information was kept from the court. Once again, I just simply have to ask, and I'm trying to think what the listeners are thinking out there. And they may have had the same thought. Did you have an attorney at this point in time? Did he understand that this was being kept away from everyone's knowledge, including the court?
No, because nobody knew about it. They didn't tell anybody. So how could we know?
Okay.
I didn't even know that she went to an interview. That was kept from us.
So mom is doing all of this activity on her own. You're not apprised of anything. The kids are going off to these counselors and being interrogated for all kinds of things that are supposedly going on in their lives. And in essence, you don't even have any contact with these children.
Correct.
Okay, go on.
So here's this statement made by my daughter, which really is a blockbuster. There's no mistaking. My mom said, you know, holy cow, now that my mom told me. I mean, how could even the one person I ran it by said that's the chink in the armor, so to speak, the one thing that people would say, oh, wait a minute, this is clearly something that was designed and implemented by an outside person, meaning mom.
Is that in the chart notes, or is that something that was hearsay? How do we know that she said that?
Because about a year later, I got a copy of the DVD video interview,
uh-huh.
Had it transcribed, and there it is.
Okay.
And shortly after that, there was a hearing. And I mean it in a sarcastic manner. You have to develop a bit of a sense of humor about how farcical this is. But my mom wanted to see her grandkids. I mean, they see their other grandma. So the therapist said, no, we don't think that's a good idea right now because we're dealing with the kids trying to get back together with dad. So my mom filed a motion and said, look, I don't care if Lisa, my wife, is there. I don't care if their mother's there. I just want to see them. You know, maybe take them to lunch or go to the park. you know, that any grandmother would do. Not asking for any special favors. She doesn't want to drive away with them and go somewhere. Just, you know, let me sit with them. And I have the transcript, and the head therapist, this woman named Valerie, said under oath in court that she recommended that my mother not see her own grandchildren because it might interfere with their therapy of my children. And why is that, she was asked. Well, because the children might recognize a facial resemblance between my mother and me, and that might upset their therapy because they might associate my mother with me, and that the allegations might come to mind and make them fearful, and it might not be good to do that yet until they've had a chance to address getting the kids and me back together. I call that family facial recognition. It's been both laughed at and cried over by a number of people I sent it to. And one person commented that it is the most absurd item he's ever seen anyone utter. Unfortunately, it gets more absurd. They said that one of the other reasons that my mom couldn't see her own grandchildren was because she might make statements that would counter what the kids were going through. That is to say, they were afraid that my mom might say, you know, Dad's a good guy. Well, the attorney said, well, she can be ordered not to say that. What about that? And the woman said, well, as long as she doesn't make any statements, but I'd still be concerned because there might be hostility there. Here's the point. As absurd as that was, what was more devastating, and I didn't know it at the time, was that that woman and the other therapist there were in contact, and one of the therapists of my daughter was at that social services interview where my daughter said, my mom told me. So here's the therapist in charge of all the therapy saying, we're worried about what grandma might say, even just to mention my name, fully aware that not 6 weeks before, that my daughter had essentially said, my mom's been telling me all these things, and yet she didn't mention it to the court. So much for, you know, the whole truth.
What year are we at now? I'm lost.
Now, this is December 2004 now.
December of 2004. I'm trying to keep track, but there's so much here. Yeah. It's so
let
difficult.
Let me round it off very quickly. I'll round it off quickly just to get to the denouement. So my mom said she could see, the judge said my mom could see her grandchildren at the therapist's office for their price, which was $90 an hour. So the therapist could see if there were any, quote, reactions or changes in the children when they saw their grandmother. My mom at the time was 75. Now she has not seen her grandchildren now in over 8 years.
Eight years.
No. She's coming up on 80, lives in New Jersey, you know, flying out to sit in the therapist's office to see her own grandchildren. Even the artificialness of the environment is absurd. So let's let that aside. But what was significant was that these therapists didn't tell the court, hey, you know what happened in this interview? And, of course, no one could mention it because no one knew it had happened. Now, in my book, that's obstruction of justice. I think the judge would have liked to have known if that had happened. So now we get to 2005 and this, quote, reunification that they've been trying to do. The woman in charge of that was appointed by this main body of abuse therapists, and she tells me that I should admit to the kids that I may or may not have done something that upset them, et cetera, and let them deal with that and acknowledge their reality.
Acknowledge their fantasy, yes.
Acknowledge their reality, and then we can move on. I said, in so many words, I said, no, that's ridiculous. Right. I didn't do anything. I'm not going to say something that's a lie and make them think that this is all real. So she said, well, then we're going to cut off the visits, and why don't you just write them a note about what you want your relationship with them to be, and I'll give it to them sometime in the future when I think they're ready. And so in February 2004, this therapist unilaterally cut off the visits. So from that time of 2004 all the way through until May of 2005, I had no contact while we tried to arrange another reunification. And another group of therapists, another therapist came on, said she could do that. That went from May of 2006, December 2004 was the hearing with my grandma, with my mom. And in February 2005 is when the therapist said, write the note or you're not going to see your kids. So,
if you wrote the note and you admitted a guilt that wasn't yours, then
I'd still be in prison.
You'd still be in prison.
Well, sure. If you wrote a note that said, "Yeah, I did these bad things," what do you think would have happened to me?
Well,
come on.
I agree with you.
Come on. I mean, so 16 months later, we try it again with a different therapist who says she's going to do this. That's May of 2006. So I saw them one time in May, then had to wait 7 weeks to see him again while this woman processed it. Now there are two other therapists involved. And long story on that is it goes till November, December, at which time the kids, quote, graduate. And then we go off to this transition period. No plan, no definition of time. There's no set schedule.
Right.
And by March, I'm totally tapped out of money.
Right.
During the time between this woman's appointment, she needed money to review the records, et cetera. I think I paid her over $10,000, and between May and December, I think we played about 15 games of Monopoly. And that was our reunification therapy.
Doc, we're not going to have enough time to finish this, but I want you to – we've got about 2 or 3 minutes.
Let me close with a couple of the high points that have come out of that.
Okay.
That here we are in the middle of the reunification. It's going to work as – and yet – they're deteriorating right under my nose, but I don't know this till again, after the fact. My daughter at the age of 10, in the middle of this, wrote a note that said, I'm Kevin now to them. I'm afraid that if I go to the visit and don't act like I'm having fun, that he might cut me open.
Uh-huh.
Because he's a doctor. In fact, I think she wrote, he will think something's wrong with me and cut me open. My daughter at 8 years old, my other daughter, wrote on a piece of paper, she didn't want to go into the room, quote, I hate Kevin, and wrote 4 or 5 times on the sheet. And then my son, at the time 6, the therapist noted that things were great, and he went out to the lobby. And she came back in to get something. And by the time she went out, my son asked her that he didn't want me to say to him, I love you anymore. There are a lot of more. The devil's in the details here. But what happened along the way is this alienation process gained momentum, gained steam, gained support.
Doc, let me interrupt you. I want the callers or the listeners to know that this story is going to be continued, that we're going to talk to you again. Excuse me. That we're going to be talking to you again because we're not going to stop this story here. This is a story that needs to be told. This is a story about situations that occur when the system, quote unquote, gears up. And it's a story that could be told, maybe not to the same degree, maybe not in exactly the same way, but it could be told by a lot of other people in our country. So will you be with me again? I guess we're going to go alternating weeks. So 2 weeks from tonight at syndicatednews.net. Can we continue this conversation, Dr. McGuire?
Certainly. And it's a lot to squeeze in an hour, and I can make it much more precise next time, but I think it's indicative of the complexity that gets involved. And for those thousands of parents I know who are suffering with this and their children, it's difficult. I even have, trouble sometimes thinking it happened and I was there.
I agree totally with you, and I understand that. I hope things improve, and we're going to try to help them improve. I want to say Happy New Year to you, Doc. I want to say thank you to Ruthie at syndicatednews.net, and I want to say thank you to all those who are listening. Happy New Year, everybody.
And same here, and Jim, thank you. Ruthie, thank you again. I'll speak soon when you get a chance.